and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the journalist and PR manager, Michael Mulcher. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. So please tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its development, its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you believe that that is wrong.
So I've come on to talk about Batman Returns, the second cinematic outing for everyone's favourite Caped Crusader, which was in 1992, directed and produced by Tim Burton, starring Michael Keaton, Christopher Walken, Danny DeVito, and Michelle Pfeiffer. I want to kind of talk about it and defend it, because so often in a movie franchise that actually has a lot of nadirs as well as zeniths, people seem to be down on Batman Returns, and I've never really quite understood why, because it is my favourite of all of the Batman movies.
Funnily enough, okay, that's pretty much my angle as well. I mean, you wanted to come on the show and talk about this anyway. We'd already talked about it. And I've got to be honest, at first I wasn't sure, because I thought, well, doesn't everybody love the first two Batman movies? Surely it's not until, you know, forever and stuff that people start going, oh, they're terrible. But then the main Incomparable show, the main show on this network, did a discussion about Burton's original 1989, I think it was, Batman movie. And in the process, they were, shall we say, not very kind about Batman Returns. And I was like, wait, what? What? And there was a whole, we had a whole conversation about it in the Slack and stuff. And yeah, I was like, how can you people not like Batman Returns? Are you insane? So this isn't really a response to that episode, but it did make me think, oh, okay, well, let's bump this up and get you on to talk about it. Because yeah, I agree. This is my favorite Burton Batman for many reasons, but I want to hear what you love about it. So, you know, what is it that makes it your favorite?
Let me frame this with a little bit of context here, because first off, I'm an absolute sucker for snow.
Okay.
Like any movie that that is set in a snowy environment, I am just yes, I'm down with that. I will forgive it. So many flaws, but that's not what's happening here necessarily. Also, Batman Returns, I saw the film after reading the rather breathless comic book adaptation that DC put out, because back in the day, you know, as a young lad growing up in the UK, I would see these things appear on newsstands in the local newsagents weeks before I would have the opportunity to go to the cinema, if indeed I went to the cinema at all. So, for example, I didn't see the first Batman movie until 10 years ago.
Wow.
Because my parents and I had a rather difficult conversation about the fact it was the first, I think it was the first 12 certificate movie in the UK.
That's right, it was. The certificate was, I think, was it created for that movie, or
possibly, yeah. I just remember feeling horrifically cheated because I was 11 years and 10 months old, and I mean this is a diversion, but I read and absorbed and obsessed over the book about the look of the first Batman movie. Like behind the scenes, mm-hmm, and the design decisions and everything. Years and years and years and years and years before I saw the movie. But with Batman Returns, I read the comic book adaptation, came out of that incredibly confused but utterly in love, and then watched the movie and thought, actually, it was a terrible comic book adaptation, but I like this movie all the more. So that's kind of the context of where I'm coming at from this.
So this was the first of the Burton Batman movies that you saw, or the first of that run? Had you seen like Batman Forever, for example?
No.
I saw this at the time it was released.
Yeah. It was a rare outing to the cinema. I think I went on a date. When was it? 1992.
Yeah.
I think I went on a date at the age of 14, an ill-advised and disastrous date.
Aren't all dates when you're 14?
pretty much. But I loved it then, and as part of the prep for this, I rewatched it and realized that I wasn't wrong. I still love it. I still think it's amazing because the main reason is that I think it sits in the real sweet spot between the silliness that people associated with the Batman franchise. So that great fear when the first Batman movie, the first Burton movie was announced, that it was just going to be the silly camp, 1966 style Batman.
Right, shark repellent, bat spray and all that.
Absolutely, absolutely. It sits between that and the kind of grimdark. Well, I hate the term grimdark because it's
very modern, isn't it? Well done.
Thank you. the dark, the adult, shall we say, take that Nolan has, and which I think Burton toyed with in the first Batman movie that he did, and then shied away from. First, primarily, Batman Returns is a fairy tale, and this feeds through into what I've always thought about superheroes, and have been gratified over the years to read articles and monographs about the American monomyth and the idea of America as a new culture inventing its own mythology. And superheroes are, as I believe Alan Moore has said, and maybe Grant Morrison as well, are fairy tales. They are stories that you tell over and over and over and over again, and they don't get boring because you're telling them in ever so slightly different ways. You're adding layers of complexity or stripping it back or bringing in slightly new things, but the story is always the same. Now, I think that's particularly true of Batman. He is a gothic fairy tale about this dark, brooding hero who actually is not the embodiment of evil that he first appears to be. He's actually our protector. And with the first Batman movie, I think Burton was stabbing wildly in the dark at this notion. And then with Batman Returns, he sort of, hit it absolutely dead center, where you've got the music by Danny Elfman, which is straight out of Edward Scissorhands and Sleepy Hollow.
I think he'd just come off of Edward Scissorhands to do this one
exactly,
as well, actually. Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, I like Elfman's work anyway, but this is particularly childlike, that kind of tinkling quality of kind of Christmas music that he does so well. you've got the contrast between the ugly and the beautiful, and the way those two things interact, and the way that one exposes the flaws of the other, I think is really nicely done for a mainstream superhero movie, because you have a pretty Gotham. There's snow everywhere, there's fairy lights, the architecture is much more cohesive and streamlined than it was in the first film, because, as I say, I was obsessed with the book about the architecture and the design of the first film, and while there were a lot of really great ideas in there, I think they overcooked it a little bit, so the architecture in that feels disjointed, it's pulling in too many influences. But you've got proper gothic monolithic architecture. Of course, the plaza where so much of the action actually takes, because it's a very static movie.
It is,
Is Batman Returns. There's only two or three locations. The plaza is clearly meant to mimic Rockefeller Plaza in New York, which, as anyone who's been there at Christmas time knows, is beautiful and lit up. But Rockefeller stands as a monument to capitalism, to the power of capitalism in the American system. And of course, you have Max Schreck in the in Batman Returns, played by Christopher Walken, wonderfully played by Christopher Walken. One of his better understated roles, I think.
That's not a word I necessarily would associate with Walken in most roles, and certainly not in this one, but okay.
I think he reins it in enough. I mean, there's the level of menace that he has, there's a wonderful degree of kind of quiet sarcasm, where particularly when he's dealing with the Penguin and the Penguin threatens him or
that's true. Does something he is ridiculous, devious, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes, and he basically goes, oh well, I'll just change tack, So he is the arch businessman. So you have the money man, the capitalist, the greedy man. You've got the brooding hero. You've got the freak, who is the Penguin. I don't think Danny DeVito has done as well in any role as he has in as the Penguin in Batman Returns. It's just so brimming with little character moments, from the way he grunts, the way he eats a raw fish when Shrek brings him down to yeah. announce that they're going to do the campaign for mayor. Even down to the way that he stares at the water just before he dies. You know, he can be theatrical, like he is when he stages that big faux discovering his parents and going to their grave kind of thing.
Oh yeah, falls to his knees in front of the grave.
Yes, yeah. But then there's all those little character moments which are true nature. So you've got the freak, you've got the monster, and then you've got Catwoman, who is that kind of staple.
Which is the femme fatale, which is a tragic femme fatale. Well, all femme fatales are kind of tragic, isn't it?
Yeah. So. But I think there's also a kind of, and it certainly wouldn't pass muster these days necessarily, but a certain element of feminism in her role. You know, there is a theme in there of her shaking off the bonds that society has put on her, whether it's her overbearing mother, where it's her aggressive boss who completely dominates her, whether it's her own sense of, well, a lack of sense of self-worth. So all of these archetypes, all of these characters kind of come together, and the way it's structured, the way it all clicks together is like a fairy tale, because there are things that aren't explained. The world is shown to work in a certain way, and you just accept it. The film doesn't even pause for breath when it gets to some ridiculous conceit. It just keeps going. And I think that's one of the things that I enjoyed so much about the rewatch that I did the other day, was just how breathless this film is. It does not waste any time whatsoever. I mean, even to the point where some of the really clever lines in the script are just almost lost.
Kind of thrown away, yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily remember them if I hadn't read the comic book adaptation, where when they're on the written page, they really pop out. Some of the kind of oblique lines that the Penguin puts out, and the relationship between Batman and Catwoman. And I think watching it through again, it felt really magical. And I think that's ultimately Burton's raison d'etre. That's the thing he does. He creates a world that follows certain rules, and it feels magical, and you don't question it, and it just keeps going. I think when you have these quote-unquote more mature movies, they feel the need to shy away from things that are patently ridiculous, or, you know, a cynic might go, well, how does that work? Because it's a superhero movie, you know? And I think Burton was the first and really only director to understand how noir and the fantastical actually meld together in Batman's work. It's an understanding of Batman, I think. Grant Morrison, who did Gothic around about the Batman Gothic 1990, and you also get people like Peter Milligan, who did kind of Dark Knight, Dark City. It is that the combination of the dark, of the noir, and the silliness. So I think, like I said some time ago, this film sits halfway between the silliness of 66 and the kind of darkness of 2005, when you had Nolan come in.
I think you and I are pretty much of one mind on this thing, yeah, because that is fairly close to my take on it. Where you say fairy tale, I say sort of gothic opera, But I mean, they're kind of, we're dancing around the same thing there. I mean, is even, I hadn't noticed this before, but I noticed it this time. At one point, quite early on, I mean, not only does it start with a church organ, for heaven's sake, literally the first, you know, notes of the movie are a church organ, but the soundtrack quite early on has a snippet of the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy in there. Just few bars. Like, you know, if you're not sort of listening for that sort of thing, you won't notice it, but yeah, very, very subtle. And yeah, the whole thing is, as you say, kind of magical. It's very larger than life, very fantastical. The architecture, so you'll know because you had the sort of, you know, the art design book of the first movie, but on the first movie, Burton worked with Anton First, a British production designer who came up with that whole sort of permanently locked in the 1940s 1920s Art Deco style, you know, all that sort of stuff. And as you say, there was a lot in there. It wasn't as cohesive as this, but it was kind of, I mean, it set the tone for Gotham as a whole in across screen media, certainly, pretty much like ever since.
No, absolutely. I mean, particularly if you look at the animated Batman, you know.
The animated Batman was deliberately made to cash in on the success of these movies, so that you can understand. But even cartoons since then, Batman cartoons since then, and the Arkham video games, and even the TV series Gotham, they have all continued that vision of the sort of, Art Deco revivalist, big monolithic architectural Gotham, as you said.
Isn't that part of the American obsession with the Gothic nature of the East Coast? That kind of... So even when you get somebody like, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald with The Great Gatsby, there's a certain degree, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but there's a certain degree of darkness, of the Gothic, of the old world.
It's the grandeur, isn't it?
The East Coast. Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting that you referred to Batman Returns as an opera, because there is something fundamentally Germanic, not just about the movie, but about Tim Burton's oeuvre.
His obsession with forests, for a start.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think you, with this kind of thing, you're plugging into the American psyche that only goes back so far, because the country didn't exist as an entity, prior to 250 odd years ago. But prior to that, and I'm about to get historical, and I'm very sorry, you have a continent that is essentially a dark continent. Now, I'm obsessed, as you know, with the English Civil War, but also kind of the wider mentality of the Puritans, who we exported to the New World in their tens and tens and tens of thousands.
Right, because Europe wasn't pure enough for them.
absolutely. Absolutely. They wished to establish a theocracy. It's one of the great ironies of America.
Of the Republic, yeah.
that one of the first things they said was, you know, religious freedom, which they would have been, you know, the original Puritans would have been aghast at the very idea of anyone being slightly different to them. There's a change in the way that the Puritans talk about America in the late Tudor period, as you're starting to get these colonies being set up in the New World. And into the 17th century, you know, there's people talking about this new Arcadia, this new paradise, this Eden that God has given to the faithful, and we will go there, and we will be the new Adam and Eve. Within a matter of years, the language begins to change, so that America becomes a wasteland that must be tamed. It becomes this dark continent. It becomes this thing that will not be controlled, because as many of the Puritans found out, particularly New England winters are particularly inhospitable. The land is difficult to till. There are, you know, endless forests. This continent is many, many, many times the size of the country you've just come from. So what that plants in the American soul is a deep fear of the unknown, of nature and the wilderness being untamable, and the dark horrors that exist within. And then you get out of that the American Gothic tradition, which is accentuated by The sheer age of the East Coast. I feel, you know, these great cities, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, that really take on the aspect of the old of the dark satanic mills that that you have back in the old country. And so, yeah, roundabout way of saying, the Gothic sits at the heart of the American experience. For all of its frontier, forward-looking, bright, happy future, there's always that lingering fear of the dark, of what lurks, not just in the forest, but in the human psyche. And Batman is an extension of that. He is the dark part of the human soul, where we know that if we went, we could deal with all the things that threaten us. We could take on the dark, but we would have to assume the manner of the dark. We would have to wear the clothes of what we fear, and therefore have the crux of Batman, which is that he takes on that mantle for us. He is the demon that nonetheless protects.
Right, he's the shaman who sort of, you know, can be the can encounter the fantastical to keep the rest of the tribe safe.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, it's kind of a fancy all over the place kind of explanation is one of the reasons why I like Batman Returns, because Tim Burton nicely plugs into this East Coast Gothic and wraps it up with lots of archetypes, with lots of ideas. But I think where he went right with Batman Returns and didn't go right with Batman, because, you know, everyone's allowed one mistake, is just there was too much competing in the first Batman film.
Right, Batman Returns is much more, I mean, ironically, given that it has more villains, it feels like a much more streamlined movie.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think, as a side note, that works because all of the villains and the lead character are trapped in the same continuum. The one of the difficulties, I think, with the later films is that there's been a tendency for Batman to essentially face off against each of the villains. So, you know, Schwarzenegger's got to have screen time. You know, Jim Carrey's got to have screen time. And although they kind of bond together at the end and they have their plots and everything, there's too many egos going on. But there's just something about DeVito and Pfeiffer and Walken that they all nicely fit together, and they all have an individual relationship with each other.
Right.
You know, their connecting story is not Batman. They're all competing against each other.
Right, no, their connecting story is actually Shrek, the only character who was created for the movie.
yeah, exactly. He is the insider. He is the catalyst who creates all of this. Absolutely. I think it holds together far better. What I noticed more than anything rewatching the original Batman is just how 80s it still feels, even though I know it's 1989, but the culture moves on and you're starting to get into that kind of early 90s period. And I think it's just a little bit uncomfortable. It's trying to be modern. It's trying to throw off the shackles of the 60s TV show. But with Batman Returns, I think Burton and the production team, the writers all kind of went, well, actually, we need to kind of ignore that. So there's nice little touches. There's nice little contemporary touches, even amongst all the 1940s paraphernalia. I love the contrast. The first time you see Bruce Wayne, he's in his mansion.
He's just sitting
in
there.
The dark. Yeah. And his face rested on his fist and the bat signal comes through the window, which, even as a kid, I thought, wasn't that a dead giveaway if you basically shine the signal at, vaguely over there, and then all these other little spotlights.
Right, anybody watching the lights from the distance would go, hang on a second.
Yeah, like a really unsubtle way of alerting yourself to this other big unsubtle thing. It's a wonderful moment, and I think that moment sums up Batman's brooding menace far better than any moment in the first film.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah,
and it's something straight out of the comics as well. Let's face it. You know, you could see that being drawn by Mazzucchelli in Batman Year One.
Year One, absolutely.
Yeah, something like that. But contrast that with how Burton keeps bringing Bruce Wayne, especially, down. He makes him actually a figure of some comedy about how different he truly is to Batman as a personality. There's this wonderful line that I'd forgotten completely about, where somebody criticizes Batman, and Bruce Wayne goes, "He probably saved millions in property damage alone," and he mumbles it almost under his breath.
It's when he's walking along the street with Selina Kyle, yeah.
Yes, and it's just, that's so nicely done. That's a wonderful character moment where, because Bruce Wayne is just a businessman.
Well, I've said for a while that I think Keaton is still the best Bruce Wayne there has been on screen.
Oh, 100%.
He's not a very good Batman.
No.
I think once he puts the suit on, especially given those early suits where you know, could barely move, he's not very good then. He's not imposing enough. He has weird facial expressions. Not great. But as Bruce Wayne, he is almost perfect. He is so good. He is so great at that kind of slightly, you know, on the edge personality. Mm. But as you said, still plays it as the businessman. He's not the crazy playboy, but he is, you know, he's sort of just a little bit unhinged.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, one incident that comes to mind is from the original Batman film where he's at Vicki Vale's apartment, and he picks up the poker when the Joker arrives. He picks up the poker and goes a bit mad to incite the Joker to shoot him, and of course he's got the tea tray under his shirt, so he's fine. That still seems a little rough. That still seems a little odd. You know why he's doing it, but it stands out. I think that was a rough edge of the portrayal of the character.
But the whole of that first Batman movie, I think, has those rough edges. That's why I think this one is so much better.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's ultimately the point I'm coming to, which is where they've smoothed off these rough edges with Batman Returns, and so you have these little quips, you have these little moments, that wonderfully awkward date that they have at Wayne Manor, which is just, oh, it brims on the surface, and you think, how can neither of you know what's going on? But there's all that subsumed sexual tension. And to a certain extent, not subsumed all that well.
Right, not entirely all subtext, no.
but she. One of the reasons why I think their relationship in this film works so well is because she challenges her unbridled nature, whether it's her passion, whether it's her aggression, whether it's ability to cut through. You know, she makes some wonderfully cutting remarks all the way through the film, where she undercuts the pomposity of people like Shrek, but also of Bruce Wayne. That fundamentally challenges him as a character. And, you know, it's that whole thing about is Catwoman, is Selina Kyle essentially Bruce Wayne's foil? You know, is she the only woman that he feels can match him and outcompete him and all this?
Well, and can understand him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's that wonderful moment in Batman Returns where towards the end where he says, you know, we're the same.
Yeah, the dark mirror concept, which, you know, obviously so many writers have explored with Batman and the Joker, but I think it is, you know, and I think some people have explored this in the comics as well, between him and Selina being, yeah, you know, possibly even more of a reflection of one another.
Yeah.
Because he's a hero who does bad things to be heroic, and she's a villain who occasionally does good things to, you know, get away with loot.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes, I'm not a massive Catwoman reader. I've not read the full, gamut of her adventures, but sometimes it feels like they're overplaying the kind of cat burglar aspect a little bit much, and I think that takes something away from her. The slight kind of psychopathic tendencies. But of course, the irony about Batman Returns is the very things that attract Bruce Wayne to Selina Kyle / Catwoman are the very things that mean that she could never settle for him.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. Well, and vice versa, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's just that ending where she snogs Shrek, and you literally get sparks. That was a wonderful bit of kind of on the nose symbolism at the end there. And also that really confused me because even when I saw the movie, I didn't know what a taser was.
Oh, right.
I'd never encountered, I didn't know what the concept was. She kind of reacts to Shrek and there's all this fire and he goes up in flames and everything. And then you have that kind of slightly tacked on ending just before the credits, which I think was filmed after principal photography. And so Michelle Pfeiffer wasn't available where.
Do you mean with Catwoman looking up at the bat signal? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because they had a view to doing a standalone Catwoman movie, which through various incarnations eventually became the excretable Halle Berry Catwoman movie. And it is tacked on because I think the fairy tale ending is actually she disappears.
Right.
She's not still out there. She just vanishes like a vapor, like a spirit. And Batman should at the end feel utterly alone again.
He does, but she has changed him. That's the other sort of fairy tale like aspect of it. She has changed him. I mean, you can see that through the sort of, as you say, you've got that climax bit where he says, "Oh, we're the same, you and I," and he rips off the mask, which just happens to rip off in a way that perfectly frames his face. That's convenient.
And takes the eyeshadow off from around his eyes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, because the eye hole, in order to see where he's going, he's got to have these huge eye holes, but then his eyes are always in shadow.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's just so blatant when you watch it.
I'd forgotten about that. But the other thing is, and this is just a tiny little thing, but at the end, when he is driving away with Alfred, and Alfred says, a Merry Christmas to all, sir. And he says, yeah, and goodwill to all men. And then he pauses, looks at the cat that he's just picked up off the street and says, and all women. And that's the end,
Yeah.
And it's a tiny little thing, but that is, that demonstrates she has changed him. He wouldn't have had that thought if he had never met her. And so.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what I don't like about that is that he is tipped off to the idea that she is still out there.
Oh no! Sure. I know.
I think actually he seems a little bit too much like hope for the end of a Batman film. I understand perfectly where you're coming from on that. I like how all the characters are attracted to each other for various reasons, but all grate each other like they could never fit together. There's no buddy movie here. There's no because you had the Riddler and Two-Face and Mr. Freeze. I think. No, wait. Batman Forever was the Riddler and Two-Face. Batman and Robin was Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
They were too chummy. It was, shall we destroy the all the way back to the spirit of 66. Oh, shall we try and destroy the Batman together? Oh, yes, well, here's a one-liner. Oh, here's another one-liner. And then, they try and destroy the Batman. And that just, the characters, the villains in Batman have never felt as real, bizarrely, I think, like real people as they have in, like they do in Batman Returns.
I think some of that definitely comes down to the performance. You mentioned DeVito's performance, I mean, which is great. Apparently, he was really uncomfortable in all that makeup. That was Stan Winston designed all his prosthetics and makeup. And apparently, it was really, really uncomfortable. But he said that actually helped him. That helped his performance. So, a lot of that sort of grunting and snorting and just general disgusting stuff that he does is actually just because he was really uncomfortable. He sort of channeled it all, which, just is the sort of thing that a great actor will do, but also lends that kind of verisimilitude to the performance. The other thing I was going to mention, you mentioned the terrible, sort of quasi-date at Wayne Manor. One of the things I noticed this time watching it through, because... You're right, that is terribly awkward. It's uncomfortable. it's tense. It's, you know, it's just horrible until the point that they start kissing, basically. The whole thing is just really, really toe curling. And I realized, we talked about Danny Elfman briefly earlier. If you listen to the music is really, it's not what you would expect from that scene in if that were a traditional scene. It's really tense music. It's all single high strings on like sharps and flats. It's the sort of music that you would expect in a movie where something really bad is about to happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they're queuing up the audience that something really bad is about to happen. And then once they kiss, then the music changes and it goes into major keys and it gets quite romantic and stuff. But if you're not paying attention to that, and I certainly wasn't the first few times that I watched this, I only noticed it this time around. You know, as we all know, music influences us subconsciously when we're watching music and influences the mood. And I think that's a good example of, you know, Elfman and Burton working together so well, because obviously it was meant to be an awkward scene. And so adding the music into that as well to really reinforce that, but in a kind of subtle way, I just thought was so good, and again sort of adds to the feeling of the whole thing being some grand gothic opera.
Absolutely and all those high strings, I mean they follow Michelle Pfeiffer around all the way through the movie, like during her transformation into Catwoman. You know, it's almost like fingers down a chalkboard.
Right, yeah.
They're so harsh, but you're absolutely right. In that date scene, the contrast of the music just shows you just the stakes, the emotional stakes, you know, not necessarily the plot stakes, you know. Yes, I suppose they could work out that they are Batman and Catwoman. They could suddenly start fighting, you know, everything could be revealed, but that's not what the tension in the scene is about. It's about two people struggling massively to get in touch with their feelings. And being honest. And the first honest moment is when they kiss. And so it is a scene of high tension. It is a scene of as you say, toe-curling tension. But Elfman's very good at that. He's very good at playing off your expectations for music in a scene and using contrast and the unexpected to lead you down a different path. And I think that only just makes that scene even better.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's interesting is that the film nearly destroyed Burton and Elfman's relationship.
Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating that it did. But, I mean, if you look at the length of it, I mean, it's what, 90-odd minutes long?
More than that, it's almost well, 2 hours.
The film is almost 2 hours, but I think the score...
You're right. Yeah, yeah, it's one of the longest scores. I think Elfman said that it was the longest score he'd ever done at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's always there. It's always present. But it's amazing. And you know, I don't think Elfman's ever done something as in depth and contrasty since, because all the other films, the mainstream films he's worked on, have been much simpler actually in terms of what they're expecting the score to do.
Right.
Whereas, you know, you have almost in the manner, well, in the manner of an opera, you have the themes,
the leitmotifs. Yeah,
you know, each character has a theme. Yeah. They play with each other and they overtake each other and they undermine each other and they keep coming back. So you're entirely right when you describe it as something that's operatic. Like I said, it's ironic that it nearly destroyed their relationship, because I think it's their best work together.
I probably wouldn't disagree with that. One thing I was going to say, in sort of talking about the Batman movies overall, I don't think that any of the Batman movies that we have had so far have been flawless or have been superb. The Dark Knight is definitely the best of the Nolan ones, but even that has got big problems, I think, especially towards the end. And, you know, none of the first run, if you like, you know, the sort of the Burton, Schumacher, whatever movies were, again, perfect. But I think this is definitely the best of them. And I would certainly rather watch this than, I don't know, Batman Begins or something any day.
Oh God, yes, no, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. These days, if you criticise the Nolan films, you're opening yourself up to a world of pain from commenters online who will tell you how wrong you are.
I am a massive Nolan fan. I will defend Nolan in many instances where other people will criticise him. I think Nolan is one of the best and most exciting movie directors to come along in the last 10 to 20 years. But his Batman movies are not his best work, in my opinion.
No. It's because he's struggling with the same problem that Burton had solved, which is, how do you reconcile a man who dresses up in a rubber bat suit and fights crime in a dark and gritty environment that's meant to be realistic and scary? How do you reconcile those two things? Because one is fundamentally ridiculous, but the other one is recognisable from any crime show. You know, it's like suddenly inserting Batman into Special Victims Unit. You know,
right. You know, and not as the offender.
Yeah, not as the offender, exactly. Because the nature of vigilantism is actually an anathema. The it's one of those things where it's a power fantasy that we all entertain. But actually, when it happens, it's very scary because it is the breaking of the rules. It is somebody taking the law into their own hands. I would hope, and this is a conversation for another time, perhaps, recognize that the rules are there to protect everybody. So even when we see injustice, we understand that the rules that may possibly enable that injustice are there for a specific reason.
Yeah.
Though, you know, that's not saying the state is always perfect, blah, 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 blah. With the Nolan films, I think the pendulum swung too far back away from Joel Schumacher period, which was high camp. It was ridiculous. If you only absorb it on that level, then absolutely it works. But that's not what I want from a Batman film. And in the same way with Nolan's Batman films, this po-faced,
humorless,
absolutely humorless. And I think that's why I name-checked Grant Morrison and Peter Milligan and their early 90s work on Batman, because that was exactly the period, when the Burton films came out. It's exactly the period where Batman is really struggling, I think, to reconcile the old comics, the old Batman, the 1960s and 70s Batman, with the Frank Miller age, where you have concepts and ideas, you have the Silver Age butting up against the Bronze Age. And Morrison and Milligan's work is not flawless in that time. You know, they struggle with that question. But I think Burton did as well as either of them at bringing all the different bits about the ridiculousness. You know, a man who keeps a giant penny in his bat cave. You know, a villain who looks like a penguin, and yet it's meant to be about crime, it's meant to be about protecting people, it's meant to be this dark gothic nightmare of East Coast urban decay. There is a spectrum, and I think Batman Returns is when the pendulum, even the stop clock is right twice a day. So I think Batman Returns is where the pendulum just struck that one time, somewhere in the middle of those two things.
Right, just precisely plumb, and every other movie has been swung one way or the other. It's
absolutely.
Actually, talking about this movie, Roger Ebert didn't like Batman Returns. But he said it was because superheroes and film noir don't go together, because the very essence of noir is that there are no more heroes. Which, is a point you can argue. But one of the things one of the reasons I think this does work is because I think maybe there's a certain recognition of that. Because one of the other things I noticed watching this time with a more sort of, note-taking analytical eye, is that it's almost 40 minutes into the movie before we get any meaningful scene with Bruce Wayne stroke Batman, apart from the very opening, when he goes in and sort of rescues the city from the clowns in the Batmobile. But he barely says anything. He doesn't even really do an awful lot in that opening movie. It's just so that he's there. And after that, you get almost a full 30 minutes without him at all.
Yeah.
With literally, he's just not in the movie at all. And even then, his first meaningful scene is a reaction to Penguin's emergence. And in this movie is all about the villains. You know, Batman is not quite a bit part player in it, but he is not, he's not the driving force. He is certainly doesn't have the most screen time. You know, it is all about these three villains, the relationship between them, the thematic similarities between them. They're all pale and wintry with white faces and pale hair. They all wear gloves.
I only
noticed this time as well. All three of the villains wear gloves. How strange. So maybe there was a certain amount of recognition of that, of like, if we're, you know, of making it a bit of a noir, let's focus on the villains rather than the hero. And even, as we've said, the hero in this movie, more than any of the other of the sort of Burton era of Batman movies, acknowledges his dark sides and acknowledges that, you know, he is kind of
unhealthy.
Right. Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Yeah.
To be honest with you, so often Batman is the least interesting in a story. He's the least interesting character because he is so straightforward. You know, all this stuff about, oh, the world's greatest detective. I can't remember what story it was. I think he's with the Justice League, where they face this massive threat, like world-ending threat. And then at the end, Batman just sorts it. And the whole point, it might have actually been a Grant Morrison story.
I think it's a Grant Morrison JLA you're thinking of, yeah, where Batman's basically, he figures out how to win within minutes.
Yeah, it's like, oh, he's the world's greatest detective. So you've lost before you even realise that you're playing. And I got really angry. I think that's when I stopped reading superheroes for a little while. Because I understand what Grant was trying to do. Well, not trying to do, but doing. And coming back to it, it's amusing and interesting. But at the time, I was just like, oh, massive swear word off, you know?
Be off with you.
I was, because where's the struggle in that? Because once you've gone there, there's no coming back narratively from that. It's like the whole thing about Superman turning back, you know, being able to reverse time. You kind of go, well, what if you can do that? Then you end up with Mark Miller's Red Son.
But it can only do it once. It's the it's the Roger Rabbit principle. There's a line in Roger Rabbit, I always loved it, when he escapes he's been handcuffed for ages with Bob Hoskins' character, and then he just later on at one point he just slips out of the cuffs, and Bob Hoskins says, are you trying to tell me that you could have got out of those cuffs at any time? And Roger Rabbit says, no, not at any time, only when it was funny.
Yes. No, absolutely. No, I get where you're coming from there. I get where you're coming from there. Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is we've diverted away from the movie, but I think it comes back to what I was saying about the Nolan films, which is that if you're going to deal with ridiculous concepts, then just go with it, lean into it. Don't be embarrassed. And I think particularly as you go through the Nolan trilogy, the sheer embarrassment that they, you know, that it's clear that the scriptwriters, the filmmakers have about dealing with a man in a rubber bat suit. And they're trying to make him as cool as possible and have all these amazing things. But they have cut themselves off at the knee. They cut themselves off at the knees by ruling out all the things that make Batman fun. I mean, let's take Batman Returns for an example. Okay. He has a weapons belt that appears to operate without him operating it. He has a car that narrows down to a third of its width.
That one's ridiculous, that is, isn't it? For jettisons a whole two-thirds of its size.
Exactly. For a road that is clearly meant to be a road but cannot admit the width of a car. you've got the bat boat, which can only go down sewers of a certain size, and they have to be perfectly round, otherwise, you know, he can't go any. I mean, jet-powered boat, for God's sake, in a sewer.
You have the Bat CD player.
The Bat CD player. You've got bats in the Batmobile, like, just in a box.
That one really, I'd forgotten all about that, and I was like, wait, he just keeps, like, a bag of bats in the back of the Batmobile?
And that's one of the wonderful things about this movie, is that the sheer number of animals, because obviously, you know, they've chosen the two villains that have animal avatars.
Penguin and Catwoman, right, yeah.
And so the cats act in a certain way. We've got weaponized penguins, for goodness sake, you know, and bats that seem to do whatever you tell them to do, which, as somebody who once had a bat in his dining room, I can confirm that no amount of persuasion will make it stop circling around and around the lampshade in a really freaky way. Bats are really scary.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the point, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know, you grow up with this stuff, so you just kind of accept it as fact. Oh, you know, bats are scary, blah, blah, blah. He's got pointy ears. And you go, well, he's got pointy ears. Bats aren't that scary, you know, because you grow older and you realise that the concept of blood-sucking bats, you know, is an exaggeration. And although they exist, you know, they're not going to fly in through a window when you live in Blackburn.
And suck your blood.
Suck your blood. Though I did enjoy, what book was it? I used to have this book that I read obsessively. I think it was kind of like a proto, it was like 14 Times for Children. And it was talking about vampires and talked about this German guy who was so obsessed with the idea that he was going to be killed by a vampire. He would sleep surrounded by garlic with a crucifix over his chest. And he would balance a globe of garlic on his lips. So he'd lay back and balance it on his face so that the vampire couldn't kiss him and steal his blood. And of course he choked to death because his mouth opened up and he half swallowed the glove. Anyway.
Sorry, you shouldn't laugh. But you
go through all of this. And I think the film, like I said earlier, the film doesn't bat an eyelid. When it plays it for laughs, it plays it for laughs. And it's funny. Like when the car narrows down to a third of its size, you're too busy going, what?
Yeah.
To, you know, kind of question this, but it fits in perfectly. You know, knocking a clown out by firing a bolt into the wall behind him and then pulling it so hard that part of the wall comes out and knocks him out.
Which is actually a pretty cool move.
it's cool. That's the thing. It's cool, but ridiculous. But you accept it because it's cool.
Yeah.
And I think so much of, like I said, the Nolan films was spent almost apologizing for the ridiculousness of the notion that it left out the fun.
I think part of that came from Nolan's realization that, like, the vast majority of the world knows him as the Batman guy. And I think for a filmmaker like Nolan, that probably horrified him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And as you say, the first one's good. It's not, none of them are without their flaws, but the first one is good. By the time you get to the third one, and I just lost all hope.
Oh, actually, no, I thought Batman Begins was pretty awful. It was The Dark Knight that I
thought
was the best of the three. I thought Batman Begins was so dreary, probably because it wasn't originally a Batman script.
Oh, was it?
That was actually a Doctor Strange script that was then kind of hammered into Batman shape.
Oh, how utterly wonderful.
Yeah.
They're becoming interchangeable. That's great.
And even The Dark Knight wouldn't be anywhere near, you know, as good as it is without Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
Is absolutely the star of that movie.
But don't you think Heath Ledger's performance does pretty much what Catwoman does in Batman Returns? It subverts. It subverts the ridiculousness.
Yeah, obviously, it pricks the pomposity, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that is the scariest thing, I think, with villains like that is not necessarily that they're vicious or they're nasty, because Michelle Pfeiffer isn't all that vicious and nasty. It's that somebody can, and I'm going to paraphrase Shakespeare here, take the pin and poke it through the castle wall and farewell, king. You know, that all it takes is somebody just to go, this is stupid.
Yeah, actually, that's a bit ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. But not in a way that undermines the experience that you're having.
Right. Well, and that's the trick, isn't it? That's the balancing act.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that Burton does very well.
Yeah. And I think that's the point at which Ledger's portrayal went too far for me, was that it subverted the entire film, like the entire premise of him going, well, you know, you're just a ridiculous man in a bat suit. And you go, yeah. Thanks for reminding me about that.
That's $10 well spent.
Yeah, exactly. That demonstrates to be what I was trying to ignore. So I think really in that kind of fairy tale context, that world of invention, but where it accepts its invention, you know, it leans into it, it lives with it, it breathes it. I think that's why Batman Returns is such a better film. And as I said before, it's the small moments. It's the moments that you almost miss sometimes. One of my favourite things, actually, when I first saw it was two favourite things, actually. It's when Catwoman has been smashing up the Shrek department store, and Batman and Penguin are confronting each other outside, and she just cartwheels towards them, you know, and they just stand there and they watch her. There's no, you know, Batman's not even on his guard. They just stand there and they watch her, and she stops, obviously pleased with herself. You know, there's a little smile on her face, and then she goes, "Oh, okay, meow." The store blows up,
explodes behind her. Yeah,
yeah, that's just really nice. You know, a character moment embedded in an action moment, and that goes through to that great line, simple line, silly line, almost throwaway line. Yeah, you think anybody could come up with that, but where? At the party, a party which, incidentally, they were playing an easy listening version of MC Hammer's "You Can't Touch This."
I noticed that he's no Prince, man.
But you know, there's the explosion, and the Penguin appears, and he just goes, "You didn't invite me, so I crashed." And it just, what an entrance! What an entrance in that moment. You know, there's something really grand about it. But the other small thing, and it's a detail, it's meaningless. When he sends the Penguins out to blow up Gotham City, the woman who controlled the monkey, no, not the monkey, the little dog.
Yes.
You know, the little dog that catches the batarang.
Oh, yes, that's the other thing, talking about devices. My God, that yes. Batarang.
Absolutely.
Programmable batarang, and everybody just stands there and watches while he programs it.
It's brilliant. So it's almost like they're mesmerized by this by this man tinkering
technology.
With his little toy.
So sorry, the woman who controls the dog. Yes,
she's doing the announcing. You know, she's got a wonderful. What was the name of the ship from Ulysses 31? Spaceship Odyssey. There we go. She sounds just like. The computer from the Odyssey in Ulysses 31. So it's kind of that spooky, kind of offhand, emotionless voice. She sat in an igloo.
Yes.
She is controlling hordes of detonating penguins, missile-carrying penguins, while sat in an igloo. That's ridiculous. That's utterly preposterous. I mean, yes, she's in this kind of winter, you know, kind of zoo, winter wonderland thing. But number one, what is an igloo doing up there? Number two, why is she sat in it? Why is that the communications hub for these penguins? And number three, when the gang, when the circus gang start to abandon the penguin when they realise that everything has gone wrong, all the clowns kind of gamble off, looking guiltily behind them. She just fades into darkness.
Yep, just fades away into the shadows.
Yeah, and even as a kid, I was like, oh, that's creepy.
Yep.
You know, is she the true puppet master that's been controlling everybody all along? But anyway, yeah. But it's design notes like that. It's character notes like the ones we've talked about. You know, you have a mordant wit throughout. So there's that great thing where Batman drives into the centre of Gotham City to confront. The gang that's smashing everything up, and they've got a fire breather who isn't even a particularly good. I suppose he's meant to be like a flamethrower, you know, actually have a flamethrower,
a human flamethrower, yeah,
yeah. But of course, all he can do is blow flame as far as his breath will allow. So he kind of blows a bit of flame at the Batmobile. He is of no threat to Batman whatsoever. You know, he's burnt up a bit of a shop. He's not going to cause any damage to the Batmobile. He doesn't actually seem to be paying attention to what's going on around him at all. Batman puts down the turntable in the middle of the Batmobile, turns it around, and triggers his afterburner and sets the man on fire.
Well, he had reached the end of the street as well, to be fair.
Yeah.
You know, and that car's got a fairly big turning circle.
Absolutely. But it's just that kind of slightly vicious comedy,
yeah,
I think, really sets this film apart, far more than the first one, because I think the first one was trying to be dark and edgy and didn't really succeed. But, you know, it's yeah. And what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I put a note about the penguin, the allegory. The penguin is absolutely stuffed with allegory. So the lead up to being discovered by the penguins, he's in a wicker basket. You know, he is Moses. He is floating down the river, having been cast away.
Oh yeah, and that's no accident. That's, you know,
exactly.
That's absolutely deliberate. Like the script was, there was an uncredited rewrite on the script by Wesley Strick. And he has said, you know, quite openly that was a Moses parallel.
Because the wonderful irony is that then he becomes Herod. Because you have the firstborn, the slaughter of the firstborn.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
So there's that wonderful kind, you know, full of promise, the firstborn. You know, he's floating off to his destiny, but then he becomes a monster.
Yeah, it's a terrible destiny.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it struck me when he was doing the lists, because he's writing on parchment with a quill. I mean, this is just amazing.
Yeah.
when he's writing out the first one, I was like, yeah, that's like the slaughter, that's meant to be the slaughter of the innocents, you know? And it's when you seek revenge, it's when you...
Well, and this movie's all about vengeance.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the other thing is, yeah. you know, this one could have been called like Batman's Revenge or something, because every character in it, I mean, apart from Batman, every villain in it is motivated by vengeance for one thing or another. You yeah. know, with Shrek, it's for the mayor daring to oppose him after he helped get him elected. For the penguin, it's, you know, for the being abandoned and then the city turning on him and laughing at him. And with Catwoman, obviously, it's at Shrek for killing her, literally killing her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, revenge is, I mean, as you know, revenge is so often overused in literature as the motivating principle for somebody's actions. It's so easy to say, oh, well, you did this to me when I was a child and now I've come back to destroy you.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of Eric Bristow mentality of revenge. One for the UK readers there, sorry, listeners there. But here it all works, and it's deeper than just simple revenge. You know, there's something else going on there. There's the act that was committed against each of the characters, specifically Penguin and Catwoman, wasn't just a nasty thing that somebody did to them. It struck at the heart of them as well. So you have, you know, it wasn't just that it was. That the penguin was a freak, and so his parents cast him out. You've got the issues of abandonment there, and you know, rightful destiny and acceptance and all this, that, and the other. With Catwoman, it's not just that she discovered, you know, her boss's evil plan and was killed, but his murder of her strikes at the heart of her personality, which is the conflict about her lack of self-esteem.
I do think as well, I mean, Shrek is undoubtedly the weakest of the three villains, but even his quest for revenge, you know, it strikes at the fact that he is motivated entirely by greed, you know, greed and sort of naked self-interest.
Also, I think what the mayor does to him reminds him of how powerless he actually is.
Right,
that
right.
For all of the money, he's reliant on other people.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like that. He wants to have somebody who is utterly reliant on him, so he creates the penguin as a mayoral candidate.
As his puppet, yeah.
As his puppet, because he doesn't like feeling powerless. You know, he bullies the powerless, he murders the powerless, and so, you know, and thinks he can try and manipulate people, but that comes back to bite him. The revenge, yeah, it's a very ironic, it's a very fitting fate for him. Of course, you've then got the base motif of he wanted to create a power station that would suck up power and create a power shortage. And of course, he then dies by being electrocuted
right.
by an air conditioning unit.
But although that whole thing is kind of, you know, that really, I mean, it's never spoken of again. It's just a setup for him to kill Selena.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. But it's a nice thing. And I think that's one of the things that Burton actually does well is wrapping up stories.
Yes.
Because the thing about fairy tales, certainly modern fairy tales, not necessarily when you go back to the original kind of, well, maybe with some of them, is karma, you know, that kind of cycle to stories, that what goes around comes around, that, you know, the little greedy boy is consumed by his greed, or, you know, is consumed by the thing he desires the most, kind of thing. So I think it's... Like we said, it structurally, it's the best one of the lot, I think.
Absolutely. Well, and I think just thematically, I think it's the most coherent of all the movies.
Absolutely.
And, well, satisfyingly coherent, because you could argue that Batman and Robin is coherent. It's just terrible.
True, yeah.
Whereas this is satisfyingly coherent. The whole thing feels, well, it feels like a snow globe. Doesn't it? It feels like the whole movie takes place inside a snow globe, and it is all complete and wrapped up and just kind of sits alone. You know, I think you could show this to anyone. You don't have to have seen any of the other films.
No.
You don't even really need to know who Batman is, you know, in terms of his background and all that sort of stuff. Apart from, I suppose, there are a couple of unexplained references to his parents. But apart from that, really, I think you could show this to just about anyone, and it would feel like a satisfying self-contained movie.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I did, just on that point about the parents, because is that when the Penguin goes to the graveyard, the wonderfully enclosed urban graveyard, like sandwiched between buildings, when he goes there and Bruce Wayne is watching it on TV, Alfred says, is anything the matter, Mr. Wayne? And Bruce goes, what did he say?
He makes a reference to, I can't remember exactly, but he makes a reference to the fact that
it's earlier on. It's earlier on where the Penguin announces that he's going to be searching for his parents, and Bruce Wayne just says, "Well, his parents. I hope he finds them."
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
and that's nice. That's subtle. You know, it's not being, my parents.
Right, well, that's kind of what I mean about a slightly unexplained reference.
Yes, 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 yes.
But no, I think the bit you're thinking of later is when Alfred says to him, you know, must you be the only, tragic orphan or something in Gotham City?
Yeah. And Michael Goff.
Michael Goff is just wonderful. Wonderful.
He is the best of the Alfreds ever. I agree.
I like Michael Caine just fine. And Sean Pertwee actually is really good in Gotham. I really like Sean Pertwee's Alfred in Gotham. But Goff will always be the definitive screen Alfred for me.
Yeah, yeah.
That wonderful, wonderful, understated sarcasm.
And a gentleness. You know, he is meant to be the guardian of this poor, wayward little boy who's spending his fortune dressing up at night and fighting criminals. And he just kind of accepts it because that's what he has to do. But at the same time, he's still going to protect him. Actually, talking about Alfred, there's that wonderful interaction between them. Just where... And it also harks back to the 66 stuff where they're going to block the signal when Penguin is giving the speech and Bruce Wayne uses the recording...
In the
Bat CD player. They're talking as Bruce is going to go down to the Batcave, and he rolls up his sleeve to activate a switch inside of the fish tank that opens up an entrance in the bookcase.
It's an Iron Maiden.
Yeah. And this whole elaborate thing. And Alfred just goes down the stairs and gets there roughly at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. He says, "No, I thank you, sir. I'll take the stairs."
What I love about that moment is when, because Alfred cautions, Bruce about, revealing to Selina that he is Batman, you know, that there's a risk of her discovering who he is. And Bruce harks back to the first film where he goes, "Who let Vicky Vale into the Batcave?" You know, I was working in there, and I turn around and say, "Oh, hey, Vicky, how are you?" And it's just the relationship between the two of them.
It is good, yeah.
It's just so perfect. It's just so, you know, the protecting older gent and the young boy, but the young boy who's now a man and goes, "Well, just leave me be," kind of thing. But still working together, you know. Still, there's Albert with his earphones on, operating sophisticated audiovisual equipment.
Yes,
and I may have imagined this, but I don't think you. I think you barely see Michael Gough touch anything on the console.
Oh yeah, no. He every shot you see of him, he's just got his hand out as if he's about to twiddle a knob.
Yeah,
but it just stays there throughout. You know, it's only a quick cut, and he doesn't actually do anything. No,
no, no. It's like, Lord, don't touch anything, Michael, yeah, because it's all glued together. All right? Yeah. But yeah, we keep coming back to this point, which is it is the most coherent, most well put together. The performances are great. Everybody seems to know what they're doing. It rattles through the script some great lines that you almost miss if you're not paying attention. And, you know, weaponized penguins.
And who could argue with that?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's bring it to a close there then. Michael, thank you very much for coming on the show and going through Batman with us. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about weaponized penguins?
They can find me in two places. They can find me on Twitter, where I am at Molcher, which is MOLCHER, which is mostly me complaining about how cold it is at the moment and lots of historical stuff and the occasional bit of comics. You can also find me on the 2080 Thrillcast, which is the award-winning podcast of 2080, which I host, which you can find at 2080online.com/podcast.
Excellent. And it is a really good listen. I will say to people, obviously people have probably worked out by now, you and I do know one another. And the Thrillcast is an excellent podcast if you are into, well, 2080, obviously, specifically, but even just into comics in general, because you have some really great guests on there. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I'm glad you mentioned Michael Gough, because I was going to mention him. Yeah. It's Michael Gough, so good, so good. Yeah, that wonderful piece of stagecraft that he does in the first movie, at the ball in the first movie, and again, this is Keaton playing Bruce Wayne really well. Yeah. Keaton's walking around with a champagne glass, and he finishes it, and I think he sees Vicky Vale across the room or something, and so I'll go over there, and just puts the wine glass on a statue or a bust or something, and it's like not balanced at all. You know, he just puts it down without even figuring out whether or not it's going to fall off. And Michael Gough's right there behind him, just like silently, unseen, obediently, you know, catches the glass and puts it on a tray and then moves away. And it's just wonderful because it's not. I mean, it's there. It's not that it's not called attention to, but there's no words. He doesn't need to, you know, Michael Gough doesn't mug for the camera or roll his eyes or anything. It's just there, just the dutiful butler sighing as he cleans up after his ward.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things. I mean, I presume you've seen Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes.
Yeah. The advice that Gustav H. gives to Zero about being a lobby boy is kind of the same thing with a butler. You know, he must always be in sight, but never seen.
Yeah.
He must always anticipate, needs before the needs are known. And I think one of the strengths of Michael Gough's performance is just how much he encapsulates the true nature of a good butler.
Right. Absolutely.
In the traditional British sense of a butler, you know, always there, but never in the way, always, full of solutions, never full of problems kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, right, even to the point when Selena is going away and she's like, oh, just make up a sonnet or a dirty limerick for me. And he just says, one has just sprung to mind.
But I think the strength of his performance is proven by the fact that, is it in Batman and Robin where he gets walloped? Or is it Batman Forever?
I don't know. I've only seen both of those movies once.
I think it might be Batman Forever because I think the Riddler smacks him in the face with his question mark staff when they take over Wayne Manor, and I remember quite vividly that getting the biggest reaction from the audience, which was
not
Alfred.
Wow,
you can't hurt Alfred, and like we didn't care about anybody else in this damn movie. We just cared
Alfred.
About the butler. Yeah. When he's essentially blackmailing, well, no, he's not essentially blackmailing. He is blackmailing Shrek with, you know, the hand of his dead partner, the toxic gunk from one of his recycling plants, and what about papers that prove you own half the fire traps in Gotham City? And Shrek goes, "If such documents did exist, that's not an admission." But if they did, I would have had them shredded. And the Penguin pulls out this clump, this ragged clump of paper. And he just goes, all you need is a lot of sticky tape and a little patience.
Yeah, little patience and a lot of tape.
Yeah. And every single time I'm watching a TV show or a movie and they are shredding documents, that just brings back to mind. You just need a lot of tape and some patience.
I think, wasn't DeVito the first actor to give the Penguin a sort of waddling, quasi-limp?
Ooh.
Because I think he was, and that is talking about things that have sort of carried on since, like the Art Deco architecture stuff, which, incidentally, I didn't get to mention in the main show. It's Beau Welch.
Right.
And this ties into what you were saying about the American sort of obsession with, you know, Gothicism, is that, you know, the Anton First, a British designer, was the first guy to put the sort of Gotham City vision together for the original Batman movie. But then Beau Welch, who is an American born in Pennsylvania, refined it and turned it into the grand, enormously triumphalist and monolithic Gothic Art Deco architecture that we see in Batman Returns, which has then basically been the template for Gotham ever since.
Yeah.
But that also talking about the Penguin and influence, like, pretty much every depiction I've seen of the Penguin since, including, I'm pretty sure, in the video games, he has a limp. He does that sort of waddling limp right. That DeVito does in this, and I think he was the first to do it. So, you know, there's quite a bit in this movie, I think, that influenced how Batman has been portrayed then for literally decades since. Something else that, again, only occurred to me watching this one, along those same lines. You mentioned the woman who controlled the dog. The only woman in Penguin's, sort of gang of crime, incidentally. And she looks and even sounds quite similar to Penguin's mother in the Gotham TV series.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I wondered, I mean, you know, obviously it's different. It's different actress, older, because it's meant to be his mother in Gotham and everything. But obviously in Gotham, he is, the Penguin is quite young. And is probably, you know, like the star of the series, I would say, you know, definitely the breakout performance. But yeah, the character of his mother in that actually bears a bit of resemblance to, yeah, the countdown woman, as it were, in this movie. And I started thinking, hang on a minute, is that deliberate? Could it possibly not be deliberate?
How bizarre.
Everybody goes on about Jack Nicholson as the Joker. I think Jack Nicholson was a terrible Joker myself.
Yeah,
but I know that that's not a popular opinion, but I thought he was dreadful.
Yeah, he just played him as a gangster.
He just played him as Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, that freaked me out. I'm scared of heights as it is, but that was just right. That was just awful.
But anyway. But you're really tall.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? So I'm here to talk about Batman Returns, the second cinematic Batman movie, which was directed by... my brain's gone suddenly blank. He said, looking at his notes.
Tim Burton.
Tim Burton. Oh, my God. That's a
wonderful. Do you want to take a stab at that one again?
Yes, I'll try that one again.
There was an uncredited rewrite on the strip. I can't get my bloody words out now. Hang on.
Who looks like a penguin for f*** sake?
That's all right.
Getting me impassioned.